Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One day after the biggest industrial bankruptcy this country has ever seen, the folks running General Motors have a lot on their plates. They got down to basics right away, though, trying to sell, baby, sell. Marketing from inside Chapter 11 today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by ConAgra Foods, the people behind brands like Orville Redenbacher's, Chef Boyardee, and Healthy Choice. More at conagrafoods.com. And by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com.
From the studios of WHRV in Norfolk, Virginia, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. It is the 2nd of June today. And you know, there is some cosmic irony in the May car sales numbers that came out today. With the ink barely dry on GM's bankruptcy papers, both Ford and General Motors reported their sales last month were the best either company had seen in a long time. To be sure, sales are still way down overall, but today's reports do offer some hope that the bottom is near. It took decades for General Motors to collapse. The automaker's betting it can jumpstart its comeback with a new national advertising campaign that begins today. It's all about how the company's going to reinvent itself. But as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports, it's going to take more than Madison Avenue to get car buyers revved up about GM.
Let's be completely honest. No company wants to go through this. But we're not witnessing the end of the American car. We're witnessing the rebirth of the American car.
That's how GM's new reinvention campaign kicked off today. The ad is filled with American victory images, everything from a lunar landing to boxing champ Joe Louis. GM promises the new GM will be leaner, greener, faster, and smarter. Marissa Gluck of Radar Research says the campaign is too little too late.
I think that saying now that GM is ready for change, when they haven't responded to market conditions for the last 10 years feels kind of empty. It feels like a hollow promise.
Gluck says GM's money would be better spent on a PR campaign using websites like Twitter and Facebook with honest talk about the company's mistakes and future plans. GM, in fact, has set up a special website complete with live chats, Twitter links, and even blog posts from GM CEO Fritz Henderson. Scott Lackey at Jugular Advertising in New York says GM has to answer consumer concerns directly.
And the number one consumer concern, and I'm quite sure of this, will be why should I buy a GM vehicle when they may not be in existence in 3, 4, 5, 6 months?
Consumers need straight talk, not feel-good images, says Lackey. After all, they're about to own 60% of the company. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Not long after it filed its Chapter 11 papers yesterday, GM announced it'll be closing or idling 14 of its assembly plants. Two of those 14 fall within the city limits of Pontiac, Michigan. Donna Kelly has lived in what used to be a GM company town for most of her life. Mrs. Kelly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell me about Pontiac, Michigan. What is General Motors? What did General Motors mean to this city?
General Motors was pretty much everything to the city of Pontiac. My family came from Harrisburg, Illinois, and moved up here so that they could work in the shops because there was always work here. And my grandfather worked there, my father, my husband. It used to be a booming town. Now it'll just be dead.
Do you and your family blame the Obama administration for having eased the way for General Motors into bankruptcy?
No, not really. I think this has been coming a long time. It's unfortunate that this is what it's come down to. I mean, my father worked at General Motors for 36 years, and when he retired, he figured that my mother would always be taken care of because he was a salaried employee and invested in the company, bought stock, did everything that he was supposed to do, and at least my mother didn't live to see the complete downfall of General Motors, because they always believed you support General Motors, it'll always be there for you, and now they just keep taking it away, and you have to worry about whether or not you'll even have money to pay your bills because of your pension.
Do me a favor, Ms. Kelly, and describe downtown Pontiac for me today. What's it like?
I very seldom even go down there anymore because it's so depressing. When I was a little girl, we used to go down there every Friday night. It was a booming town. All the stores were open. My grandfather worked second shift, and we'd go spend the night with my grandmother, and that was how we'd spend Friday night. We'd go down to Sears and Federals and Kresge's, you know, and just wander around, and there's nothing like that down there now.
So with General Motors all but shutting down inside Pontiac city limits, do you think there's a future for your city? Can it come back?
I would say it would be a very uphill struggle. I mean, with all the other cuts and stuff that are going on in the education and stuff coming out of the state of Michigan and the government, I think that if they ever do come back, it's going to be quite an uphill struggle. It's just sad. I'm just glad that my father isn't here to have to see this after all the things that he said over the years.
Donna Kelly lives and works in Pontiac, Michigan. General Motors announced yesterday it's going to shut down one factory in town and put another one on standby. Ms. Kelly, thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, and American Express raised a couple of billion dollars in the stock market today. The Federal Reserve told them they had to if they want to give back all that cumbersome bailout money. You might think the government would be thrilled to get paid back, but as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, it has been dragging its feet.
In order to return the government's money, banks have to prove that they can stand on their own. This week, the Fed added a new condition, that the banks show they can sell large quantities of stock to investors. Douglas Elliott is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says the government is reluctant to give up its stake.
We don't know for absolute certain that we're through the crisis. It's safer to have the additional capital. Perhaps more importantly, the administration would like the banks to be doing more lending. They're more likely to do that if they have a bigger capital base.
Elliott says the government could use the money. The repaid funds could replenish the TARP and help out struggling smaller banks. It also sends a message to taxpayers and investors that the economy is stabilizing. Linus Wilson teaches finance at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. He says raising money on the stock market shows the big banks don't need government help.
If these banks repay TARP, taxpayers win because they lose less money to the banks. And banks win because they get government off their back. And it's also a good thing that they're raising common equity because that makes them less likely to need to be bailed out in the future.
Banks like J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs have been eager to repay the TARP funds. Bankers say the money carried too high a price, restrictions on executive pay, and a stigma with investors. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Those investors were a little betwixt and between today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. World Health Organization said today that the continuing spread of swine flu, it's now in 62 countries, has pushed the world closer to a pandemic. At the same time, though, the agency says the general level of infection is moderate. International health officials are in a tricky spot. They want to warn people about a potential threat without causing panic, much like businesses want to be prepared without overreacting. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
With cases of swine flu mounting, businesses could face mass employee absences. Abi Leibowitz is chief medical officer with Health Advocate Incorporated. It helps businesses manage employee health issues. Leibowitz says global firms could see millions of dollars in lost productivity.
It can look like one of your work sites just goes offline. You may lose a facility, you may lose a call center, you may lose a manufacturing site. And so you've got to be able to function as a business.
That means having a point person to develop a pandemic response plan. A recent survey by the Conference Board found that around 55% of respondents have pandemic plans in place. But the Conference Board's Carolyn Cavicchio says about a third reported having no contact with government agencies.
That figure that, 35% weren't talking to government at all was really troubling, because the public health sector is really in the lead in responding to any pandemic.
She says companies need to be in touch with public health officials in all the locations where they have workers. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
In a speech a couple of months ago, President Obama said the biggest threat to the economy isn't the financial crisis or the recession. It's the rising cost of health care. Today, the White House Council of Economic Advisors went the president one further. The council reported that gross domestic product would actually get a boost if healthcare costs were scaled back, as much as an 8% bump by the year 2030. Dr. Atul Gawande has been trying to understand why healthcare costs are so high. He's got a professional interest. He's a surgeon. But he's also a writer for the New Yorker magazine. And the most recent issue of that magazine found him in McAllen, Texas, in search of answers to his question. Per capita, McAllen pays more for health care than almost any other city in the country, about $15,000 a year. But Dr. Gawande says it's not because McAllen is all that much unhealthier than other places, or that the people there get better care.
Instead, what we saw was just more services, more of almost everything that a doctor can order was ordered there, whether it was more ultrasounds and scans, more heart surgery, more pacemakers, more bladder scopes and knee replacements.
So it was just more for the sake of more.
Well, that's the puzzle of it. I looked at a place like Mayo Clinic, which is in the lowest 15% of healthcare costs in the country, and they do much lower volumes of all of these kinds of scans and procedures and seem to get better results out of it. And so part of what may be going on is just habit. In much of American medicine, we habitually think that more is better. The second thing I found in McAllen was fragmentation. There's multiple hospitals. The doctors go to different places, and there's no system in place to make sure that preventive care is provided. There's not overtreatment. And then the last thing, which was the dismal, somewhat depressing thing to find, was there is some layer that I encountered there of just money-mindedness, where the drive to make sure that the revenues are high, there can be a tendency in a heartburn patient to push for the idea that, that heartburn patient should get a scope, should get different kinds of studies at much higher rates than they're done elsewhere in the country.
What I hear is, and this is the point you eventually get to at the end of the article, that it's the way doctors are paid, and it's this treatment of patients as you put it, profit centers, that really drives so much of the cost of medicine in McAllen and then, by extension, the rest of the system in the country.
Yeah. When I think about money as a physician, there's three ways you can think about it. One is you just try to ignore it and hope that your expenses come out okay at the end of the month and you can pay the secretary and your malpractice premiums and the rent on your office. The second way doctors think is, hey, I've got some good money coming in. Maybe I'll use it to improve the quality of care for my patients. And so they'll hire a nurse practitioner to follow up on the diabetes patients, make sure people are all getting their mammograms like they're supposed to. And then there's a third way you think about the money, which is that you just focus on how do you maximize the revenue.
Is it reassuring then for the prospects of healthcare reform that there seems to be a lot of room to cut fat without really affecting the quality of care?
Yeah, this is why the economists get excited about seeing places like McAllen. And McAllen, by the way, is a sort of extreme form of a part of medicine that we have everywhere we go. And it's the idea that more does not necessarily result in better. In fact, it seems to make care worse. And that possibility that we could ensure that we are exposing people to less risk from less operations, we will save significant dollars for the country.
Is it possible to get this done, do you think?
Yes, but not quickly. This is about the idea that we are going to change the culture of medicine to be one where we have much more collaboration, involvement of primary care physicians, efforts to make sure that specialty care doesn't introduce more risks than benefits. In some communities, they figured that out, and we have to learn from those communities and bring it to the rest of the country. And that's very hard to do in the middle of a huge economic downturn that's hurting hospitals and doctors like everybody else.
Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He teaches at Harvard Medical School. To our point, though, he writes for the New Yorker magazine. Dr. Gawande, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Ever since the financial crisis got really hairy, the Federal Reserve has been running a hodgepodge of programs that are designed to get credit flowing back through the economy as quickly as possible. It's not overstating the case at all to say Ben Bernanke and his colleagues have been throwing money at the problem. One of those programs, the TALF, or Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, is quite possibly the biggest government program you've never heard of, even though it's providing the financing for a lot of the things you're buying. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The money comes from the Federal Reserve, not the U.S. Treasury, so the program didn't require congressional approval. Nevertheless, up to $1 trillion will be lent to big investors to buy pools of debt, asset-backed securities, they're called, in which the assets are my debt, your debt, the neighbor's debt. Here's UCLA forecast economist David Shulman.
Student loans are in this package. Small business loans are qualified collateral, and they've also opened it up to commercial real estate loans. So it covers quite a bit of lending that goes on in the economy.
Shulman says when the financial crisis started last fall,
the market for asset-backed securities stopped. So as a result, auto credit began drying up. Credit card credit began drying up. Student loan credit began drying up because the originating financial institution had no ability to take the loan and sell that loan into the marketplace.
In other words, when your bank or your car dealership makes a loan to you, they'll take your IOU, add it to hundreds of others, and sell that pool of IOUs to investors who make money on the interest you pay. That way, the IOU is at least partly off the bank or dealership's balance sheet, and they can make new loans to new people. If investors are willing to buy this debt, then lenders are able to extend more credit to you and me at a low interest rate. This way of doing business may seem roundabout, but Shulman says it's the world we live in.
The asset-backed securitization is extraordinarily important in our credit system because that's where the bulk of the loans were made in the beginning of the 21st century. So this market has to work. If this market does not work, we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Enter the federal government last November with a program called TALF. It rhymes with ALF, I know, but the only alien life forms here are the asset-backed securities. Through TALF, the government is lending investors as much as 94% of the cost of these securities, made up of new loans, to get the market for them rolling again. It's mostly rich people and institutions like money market funds that are investing. Reid Auerbach is a lawyer with McKee Nelson who is now devoting almost all of his billable hours to TALF deals. We met outside a car dealership in Manhattan, and here's why.
While an individual standing outside this dealership walking in today to go buy a car is not thinking, gee, I'm getting a low, 2% financing rate on my car because this dealership was able to package my security into 1,000 other securities and issue a TALF-eligible bond, they're not thinking that. In fact, that's exactly what's happening.
Auerbach says investor participation in the program is picking up. The Fed lent investors just a couple $1 billion a month in March and April, and $11 billion last month. That's getting closer to what investors were spending on these securities before the financial crisis. So does that mean the TALF's working? Maybe. And Auerbach says if it does work, it'll be because TALF doesn't have the same strings attached as other programs, like the bank bailout, which requires banks to submit to executive pay limits and hiring requirements. Investors are more willing to participate in TALF, Auerbach says, because it doesn't have those restrictions. Maybe because few people know about it, at least for now. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, getting busted for bling.
It's definitely racialized. There's no question about that. And the idea of bling has kind of come from the hip-hop generation. You know, diamonds, gold, $300 sneakers.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked up 19 points today, 0.2%, wound up at 87.40. The NASDAQ gained 8 points, 0.4%. Ended at 1836. The S&P 500 edged up 2 points, 0.25%, finished at 945. A nice report on sales of previously owned homes reinforced construction stocks today. Toll Brothers, Pulte Homes, and D.R. Horton each built up between 3.5% and 4%. Boeing gained altitude of more than 3%. Continental Airlines soared 11%. The maker of Botox attracted some investor attention. Allergan plumped up 4.5%. Allergan plumped up, I get it. Overseas, the markets were mixed. The 10-year T-note gained, pushing the yield down to 3.61%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for April. The Senate Special Aging Committee looks at long-term care insurance. And runners unite to promote a healthy and cost-effective form of exercise. Organizers encourage folks to lace up for National Running Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Time to check the mailbox once again. Stacey Vanek Smith's story on California's budget problems prompted some emails from you. We had asked whether California might be too big to fail, and judging by your comments, a Golden State bailout would leave the other 49 states fuming. Take this from Brian Mullinex in Monument, Colorado.
Is California too big to fail? California now wants to pick my pocket for money it can spend on state-paid daycare and other things. I don't think so. They can do what my state seems to do every single year, spend less than they bring in.
We are all spending a lot on health care. That's part of the reason health care reform is up for debate in Congress this spring. Last week, Janet Babin reported on the costs of the mandatory insurance coverage they have in Massachusetts. The fact that universal coverage does come at a cost was not lost on listener Mary Foxworth of Houston, Texas.
It was a foregone conclusion that the Massachusetts experiment in universal health coverage would run out of money and still not achieve universal coverage. The reason? The private health insurance companies are still involved, and all those customers are just a captive audience for them. No wonder some residents would rather pay the fine and go without insurance.
News of GM's bankruptcy yesterday was met with some anger and some sadness and some frustration, too. That last probably best describes Mark Roth's reaction. The computer specialist from Chicago isn't sure that cutting brands and staff will do enough to turn the car company around.
I am really tired about hearing how GM will come out of the bankruptcy leaner and meaner. What it really needs is a cultural attitude transplant.
Speaking of cultural attitudes, Devin Dwyer reported last week on how some companies are dealing with social media in the workplace, employees doing Facebook updates and Twittering about lunch plans while they're on the clock. Some companies are cracking down, some of them aren't, like the one that John Smith works for in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Our organization openly embraces the use of social media. We trust our employees to stay on task and use these sites professionally. Corporate America was afraid of the internet when it began to take off. Social media usage is catching on at a much faster rate. Organizations are going to need to address its use pretty quickly.
All right, just finishing up that Twitter post here. Be right with you. Okay. As always, if you like what you hear, or if you don't like it, or if you just want to chime in, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. A lot of people are giving up luxuries because of the recession. Police in Britain are hoping that'll give them an edge, that those living large on ill-gotten gains will stand out even more. Officers in the county of Gloucestershire in western England have posted signs asking residents to report people with overly flashy lifestyles. Too much bling, the signs say. Give us a ring. Christopher Worth has more.
About a dozen regulars down afternoon pints at Gloucester's Fountain Inn. Well-worn sweaters and comfortable jeans are the norm at what some say is the oldest pub in the city. There's little ostentation here, but proprietor Peter Rust reckons he knows bling when he sees it.
I know exactly what bling is. We've all seen the American programs where the pimps are riding around in these golden crusty Cadillacs and everything else.
But Gloucestershire detective Steve Burnside says bling means more than the kind of flashy stuff that you see in the movies.
Bling would be anything that would be of high value, that wouldn't be attributable, we would say, to legitimate earnings. And it could be anything from a big fancy car to a big fancy house.
But Peter Rust and his bartender, Kath, view police asking people to rat on their neighbors just because they're wearing gold or driving an expensive car as yet another intrusion in a country that already has more security cameras than anywhere else in the world.
It's getting into Big Brother, really, isn't it? They can just turn it around on, oh, she's got a lot of bling, he's got a lot of bling, they must be loaded with cash.
I said it's beyond 1984, George Orwell's book. We're not here to judge who they are, what they are.
Ben Bowling, a criminologist at King's College in London, fears not everyone will see it that way. He says the campaign encourages racial profiling.
It's definitely racialized. There's no question about that. I mean, the idea of bling has kind of come from the hip-hop generation. You know, diamonds, gold, $300 sneakers. And so the idea of using kind of street vernacular to identify those people who might be a bit too blingy for your neighborhood is, I think, to direct attention specifically to the black community. And that is a real problem.
The police say the campaign is meant to target anyone who displays excessive wealth. They say other British police departments have run similar campaigns with promising results. Hannah Dawes of Crime Stoppers, an organization that works with the police, recalls one in Leicestershire.
Within the first 8 days of launching the campaign, 24 people were actually arrested based on this kind of bling lifestyle. £54,000 worth of cash was recovered and £195,000 worth of vehicles were seized.
That's about $400,000, a handy injection of funds at a time when the economic downturn is emptying government coffers and squeezing spending on police departments. Police say it sends a clear message to the criminals, but cynics here say that message may just be a useful warning to the bad guys. If you've got it, don't flaunt it. In London, this is Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, we started with car sales. Let's finish with sales for another troubled part of the economy, newspaper advertising sales. Granted, it's a symptom of real changes in that industry, less of a cause of economic distress like cars are, but noteworthy nonetheless. The Newspaper Association of America says ad revenues fell another $2.5 billion in the first quarter of this year. That's a 29% drop from a quarter earlier. And it's not just dead tree ads either. The recession here is an equal opportunity employer. Online newspaper ads were down as well. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 19 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq added 8 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 lifted up 2 points. That's a 0.25% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Thanks today to the staff here at WHRV in Norfolk, Virginia. And coming up next time on this program back home in Los Angeles, not all unemployment is created equal.
It really matters what state you live in. The levels of benefits vary extremely wildly.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.